Wine Stories, a podcast to discover the world of wine by Étienne Pommier.
Hello everyone, I'm Étienne Pommier, wine authentication expert and owner of Les Caves du Lac in Annecy, France, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to this new season of my podcast, Wine Stories. This year, we will continue exploring the world of wine through journeys from famous vineyards to the most unexpected terroirs, tasting the world's greatest wines, as well as affordable and easy drinking bottles. We will also be talking about those who make wine, its culture and its history, as well as cases and debates stirring the world of wine today. There are always different angles to the same story, and depending on a point of view, the events unfolding and their perception by the different protagonists can vary greatly. Today's episode is a perfect example of how different a story can be depending on who tells it. It has made so much noise around the world of wine and has had so many repercussions on the industry that it is now widely considered a pivotal moment in wine history. However, in France, where it took place, few people actually know about it and even fewer realize the impact it had beyond French borders. To make a good story, you need a good plot with twists and surprises, and you will find plenty of them here. But you also need great characters, and all those involved in this one fit the bill. Iconic wine producers, 3 Michelin star chefs and sommeliers, as well as self-made men of humble backgrounds, all of them left a mark on the wine industry without realizing they were making history. So without further ado, let me tell you the story of a wine tasting that changed the world, the Judgment of Paris. Paris, Monday the 24th of May, 1976. In the salons of the Intercontinental Hotel, a long banquet table has been set up to accommodate a wine tasting organized by a young Englishman for a handful of French wine experts. A white tablecloth has been laid on the table, and the hotel staff has prepared for each participant a set of wine glasses, a scorecard with a pencil and a spittoon. 34-year-old Steven Spurrier has been living for 6 years in the French capital, where he runs a boutique wine store named Les Caves de la Madeleine that he purchased in April 1971. And for 3 years now, he's been also running with partners John Winroth and Patricia Gallagher a wine course provider, l'Académie du Vin. Just before 3 p.m., the guests start arriving at the venue to take their place at the table. They've been invited to join a tasting of California wines. As Spurrier explained, once they've all taken their seats, they will be poured 20 wines, 10 whites and 10 reds, some coming from California, as well as similar quality French wines. All the judges agree, and Spurrier proceeds to present them with the scorecards that they will be asked to fill, assessing the wines based on 4 criteria: eye, nose, mouth, as well as overall harmony, and give them a rating out of 20 points. In order to get an honest and unbiased opinion on all the wines served, Spurrier and Gallagher have decided to pour them in blind in neutral bottles, and the reds have been decanted in advance. After serving a Chablis 74 as a palate cleanser, Spurrier announces the beginning of the tasting as the waiters start pouring the wines. There are 9 judges who have agreed to participate in this event. First, there is Pierre Bréjou, Inspector General of the INAO, the French organization in charge of regulating the AOCs. There is also Michel Dovaz, a Swiss wine educator at l'Académie du Vin, and future author of several books on French wine. There is also Claude Dubois-Millot, sales director at the Goemillot Guide, and Odette Kahn, editor-in-chief of the Revue du Vin de France, the number one wine publication in the country. 2 wine producers are present, one from Bordeaux, Pierre Tarry, owner of Château Giscourt in Margaux and secretary general of the Association des Grands Crus Classés, and Aubert de Villene, co-owner and co-director of the Domaine de la Romanée-Conti in Burgundy. And finally, 3 judges from the hospitality industry, Jean-Claude Vrina, owner of 3-Michelin-star restaurant Taïwan, Raymond Oliver, chef and owner of Le Grand Véfour, also a 3-Michelin-star restaurant and one of Paris' oldest stables dating back to the 18th century, and Christian Vanneke, sommelier at 3-Michelin-star La Tour d'Argent, world famous for its amazing wine cellar. Aware of the tasting, Jean-Pierre Leroux and Gérard Bosseau-Deschouade, his sommelier at the nearby Sofitel Hotel, have come out of curiosity and have been allowed to stay and watch. Spurry and Gallagher have invited journalists from French newspapers Le Monde and Le Figaro, but no one has come, and only one American journalist for Time magazine, George Tabor, has agreed to cover the event. 30 years later, he would write a book, The Judgment of Paris, that I have used to prepare this episode. Little did they all know that they were about to make history in the world of wine. The idea of organizing a tasting of Californian wines in Paris in the mid-70s is Patricia Gallagher's brainchild. Spurrier and her had already made a name for themselves in the small Parisian wine world by organizing a face-off of all the Bordeaux first growth the previous year. All the producers came, except Chateaubriand, to present and compare their 1970 vintage. It was the first time such a tasting was organized, and it made enough noise to put the Cave de la Madeleine on the map. Over the past few years, Gallagher and Spurrier had heard many positive feedback about up-and-coming producers in California, and they had tasted a few bottles. But after tasting samples brought back from the US by friends and family, and having traveled to the Napa Valley to try the wines, they decided to organize a tasting of Californian wines in Paris to show the French what was going on in the Far West. Winemaking in California started in the 19th century following the 1849 gold rush, when the settlers realized why Native Americans called this place Napa, the land of abundance. The warm Mediterranean climate and fertile soils of the valley allowed to grow almost anything and proved ideal for viticulture. The first Californian winemakers had faith in their vineyards, believing they could yield quality wines, and since all of them were coming from Europe, where viticulture had been widespread for centuries, they brought some winemaking knowledge with them. In 1854, a San Francisco newspaper wrote about the wine of George Yount, the first settler in the valley. It bears a good deal of resemblance to the Bordeaux wines. With more age and perhaps a little better management, it would equal the best French wines. These pioneers came from Germany, such as Charles Krug or the Beringer brothers, Hungary, like Agosto Narasi, or France, like George de Latour. The Californian wine industry grew for 60 years until everything stopped in 1919 with the enforcement of the Volstead Act that instated prohibition in the United States. Wine production almost completely stopped in California, with few exceptions for religious purposes. And when prohibition ended in 1933, the once flourishing Napa wine industry was in a dire state. After World War II, a group of new pioneers started establishing new wineries and rejuvenating old ones, bringing a new energy in the valley, under the mentorship of the likes of André Tchelitchev, Louis M. Martini, or Robert Mondavi. Plantings in the valley increased, poor prohibition-era grapes were uprooted to be replaced by adequate cultivars, and the overall quality output of the valley increased. Napa winemakers didn't have generations of experience and tradition like the French producers did, so they experimented, and eventually it paid off. 10 years ago, a friend of mine who had lived in California introduced me to some of these old vintage Napa Valley wines, and I was very impressed by the poise of some of these classic Robert Mondavi or Beaulieu Vineyard wines. In the 1960s, the valley started attracting more and more people interested in making wine or investing in a winery. And by the end of the decade, Napa was starting to be talked about a little. But France was still ruling the world of wine, and no one would have seriously considered comparing the great wines of Bordeaux or Burgundy to anything else. Yes, there were some developments in other countries outside of Europe, such as the US or Australia, but these were deemed, by most wine experts, interesting efforts at best, but certainly not worthy of going side by side with iconic French Grand Crus. In Gallagher and Spurrier's mind, the idea of organizing a tasting of Californian wines in Paris was only to showcase the quality of up-and-coming producers from a promising region. They chose to put them in perspective with some of France's finest wines, because that's what Napa producers were trying to emulate. In March 1976, Spurrier traveled to California and tasted a Chardonnay in Joe Hyde's cellars. Asked to comment on the wine, he said to the winemaker, "It reminds me of a Meursault Charme." To what Hyde responded, "Meursault Charme is one of my wife's favorite wines, and that's what I'm trying to make." For the tasting, Gallagher and Spurrier chose 6 California Chardonnays and 6 Cabernet Sauvignon-based wines to be compared to 4 white Burgundies and 4 red Bordeaux from the left bank. Since they wanted to promote Californian wines, they didn't see it as an issue that there were more American wines. In terms of vintages, they selected vintages that were available on the market at the time, since there were no older years for Napa available anyway. For France, they opted for 1972 and 1973 white Burgundies, years with quite high levels of acid and fine tension. Bordeaux reds were from a great vintage, 1970, dubbed the best since 1961, and 1971, which was a step down but still quite good. Here is the list of wines that were served at the tasting. Chalon Vineyard Chardonnay 1974, Chateau Montelena Chardonnay 1973, David Bruce Winery Chardonnay 1973, Freemark Abbey Winery Chardonnay 1972, Spring Mountain Vineyard Chardonnay 1973, and Vidocrest Vineyards 1972 Chardonnay. And from Burgundy, Domaine Le Fleuve Puligny-Montrachet Premier Cru Les Pucelles 1972, Domaine Rouleau Meursault Premier Cru Charme 1973, Joseph Drouin, Beaune Premier Cru Claude Mouche 1973, and Ramonet Prudhon Bâtard Montrachet Grand Cru 1973. And here is the list of red wines from the Napa Valley: Clos du Val Winery 1972, Freemark Abbey Winery 1969, Hyde Cellars Martha's Vineyard 1970, Mayacamas Vineyards 1971, Ridge Montebello 1971, and Stag's Leap Wine Cellars 1973. And their Bordeaux counterparts: Château Aubryon, Pessac-Léognan, First Classified Growth 1970, Château Léoville-Lasca, Saint-Julien, Second Classified Growth 1971, Château Montrose, Saint-Estèphe, Second Classified Growth 1970, and Château Mousson-Rothschild, Pauillac, Second Growth 1970. As you can see, Spurrier did pick fine wines from premium French producers, so that the bar was set really high for California. He and Patricia Gallagher would be tasting the wines too, but their scores would not be taken into account for the final ranking. Spurrier didn't expect miracles for Napa given the competition. He was just hoping for an interesting comparison as the waiters were pouring the first wines. The first flight of white wine started quietly, but soon, judges started chatting more than it is common in such tastings, arguing about the provenance of the wines. From their comments, though, journalist George Tabor quickly realized that they were totally confused about the wines in front of them, arguing for Burgundy when it was California, and the other way around. Tabor recalls that Sofitel's Jean-Paul Leroux was shocked to realize that some of the country's finest tasters, some of whom he looked up to, couldn't tell the origin of the Chardonnays. After the judges tasted all the wines and filled their scorecards, Spurrier gathered them and added the scores to get the final ranking. When he finished, he announced the result to the judges, whose reaction was pure shock. In third place, Chalon Vineyard Chardonnay 1974, Steven Spurrier's favorite wine. In second place, Domaine Rouleau Meursault Premier Cru Charme 1973. And in first place, Château Montelena Chardonnay 1973. The whole room was in shock. As the waiters cleared the tables and started pouring the red wines, the room was still buzzing from the surprise of the results, and Spurrier was sure that the judges would be much more focused and careful tasting the reds to identify French wines and rate them high. As George Tabor puts it, one Californian wine winning was bad enough. Two would be treason. The atmosphere for the red flight was more intense and serious, with much less chatter, and the judges' comments were often spot on. "That is California, or I don't know what I am doing here," said La Tour d'Argent sommelier Christian Vaneke, tasting the 1971 Ridge Montebello. Raymond Oliver took one quick sip of a red wine and proclaimed, "That's a mouton, without a doubt." And it was. But when Spurrier announced the results for the red wines, the stir in the room was even greater than before. The wine that came out on top, beating Chateau Montrose 1970 in third place and Mouton Rothschild 1970 in second place, was Stag's Leap Wine Cellars Cabernet Sauvignon 1973. To everyone's surprise, including Spurrier's of course, California had won again. After the tasting, the judges stayed a while to debrief over a glass of champagne, and some of the reactions were complimentary. Aubert de Villene, who had married a Californian girl, commented, "I tasted my first Californian wines in 1964, and since then there have been more and more good wine houses there." And sommelier Christian Vaneke added, "The white wines approach the best of France without a doubt. The reds, though, were not as good and don't have the character of a Bordeaux." But other judges were much more bitter about the results. Michel Dovaz argued that, in 5 or 10 years, when the wines have properly matured, I'm sure the French red wines will do much better. And Odette Kahn from the Revue du Vin de France added that, it was a false test because Californian wines are trying too much to be like French wine. And she asked Steven Spurrier, "Monsieur Spurrier, I demand to have my scorecards." "I'm sorry, Madame Kahn, but you're not going to get them back." "But they are my scores." "No, Madame, they are not your scores. They are my scores now." The verdict was clear. There was no room for appeal for what would go down in history as the judgment of Paris. Two Californian wines, Château Montelena Chardonnay 1973 and Stag's Leap Wine Cellars Cabernet Sauvignon 1973, which Odette Kahn had ranked number one of all her red wines, had won in Paris against some of the best French wines. And the winemakers behind these bottles were a former graduate student in political sciences from the suburbs of Chicago and a Croatian immigrant who had escaped the communist regime. Miljenko Gergic was born on April 1, 1923, in a small village of southern Croatia, the last of 11 children. His parents were farmers and he wanted to become a winemaker, so in 1949 he went to study viticulture at Zagreb University, taking part-time jobs on the side to make ends meet. But in Tito's Yugoslavia, the dreams and aspirations of Gergic and his friends were not well received, and one day, after a student protest, some friends told Miljenko that he was being followed by the secret police and that he had to leave the country soon. He remembered the words of one of his professors who had traveled to California and described it as a paradise. So he decided that's where he wanted to go. Still a student, he obtained a 2-month visa to join an exchange program in West Germany in August 1954 and left for the West with $32 hidden in his shoes to make it to California. After staying in Germany for a while, and then Canada, he finally managed to make it to the US in 1958. He changed his name to Mike Gergich and was 35 years of age when he finally arrived in the Napa Valley. He started working in several wineries, and in 1972, he joined Jim Barrett's Chateau Montelena and made his first vintage of Chardonnay. 1973 was a slightly warm year in Napa, but without excessive heat, which allowed the grapes to ripen perfectly while keeping a high level of acid that Gergich was always looking for. Born and bred in Croatia, where the family always had wine on the table, he thought that acidity was the key to a balanced wine that could go with food. The grapes were harvested manually, crushed and pressed before fermenting in temperature-controlled stainless steel tanks. Gergich then racked them into French oak barrels purchased the year before that would now add a mellow but not overpowering oak character to his wine. In May 1974, English wine critic Harry Vaux traveled to Napa and visited Montelena. Tasting the 1973, he commented to the winemaker, "Mike, I haven't tasted such a good wine even in France." In December 1974, Chateau Montelena released 2,200 cases of Chardonnay 1973 at $6.50 a bottle. Warren Winiarski was 36 years old when he left behind his hometown of Chicago with his wife and kids to search for a new life in California. Born in 1928 in a Polish family of the suburbs, he graduated in political science at the University of Chicago, but had the dream of becoming a winemaker one day. Some would say he was predestined for it, as his name, Winiarski, meant son of a winemaker in Polish. On August 1st, 1964, driving his old Chevrolet, struggling to climb the steep sections of Route 66 across Arizona, he hoped that he had made the right choice and that the winery job waiting for him in Napa would turn out well. After 2 years at Souverain Cellars, he joined the Mondavi family before buying his own vineyards in 1970 with other investors and building Stag's Leap Wine Cellars in 1973. On September 23, 1973, Winiarski started picking his Cabernet Sauvignon, and after being crushed and destemmed, the grapes were placed in a temperature-controlled stainless steel tank for fermentation. The tank was a replica of the ones used at Chateau Latour that Winiarski had read about in a magazine. After 6 months, the wine was transferred into new French oak barrels to mature for 18 months. In July 1975, 1,800 cases of Stag's Leap Wine Cellars Cabernet Sauvignon 1973 were released on the market at $6 per bottle, and Harry Vaux's comments were laudatory. "This represents a swing away from huge Cabernet Sauvignon to a wine of more finesse and elegance, in effect, more along the lines of the Medocs from Bordeaux." The English wine critic was spot on, and both wines were bound to make history. The day after the Paris tasting, George Tabor called Patricia Gallagher to ask if she knew the whereabouts of the American producers whose wines were featured in the tasting, as he knew she had organized a wine tour for them in Bordeaux. On that day, the Californians were having lunch at Chateau Lascombe, and Tabor called the Margaux property and asked to speak with Jim Barrett, the owner of Chateau Montelena. "What is your reaction from beating the French at their own game in Paris?" "I guess it's time to be humble and pleased, but I'm not stunned. We've known for a long time that we could put our white Burgundy against anybody's in the world and not take a back seat." While still at the table in Lascombe, the Americans managed to keep a straight face. But as soon as the minibus left the chateau, they started cheering as if they'd won the Super Bowl. The following day, the group was flying back to California, and word of the Paris tasting reached Barbara Winiarski at Stag's Leap. When she told the news to her husband, he only replied, without realizing the impact this would have on his whole life, "That's nice." On June 7, 1976, George Tabor's article was published by Time magazine, and 20 million American readers discovered the story of the Paris tasting. The very same day, wine shops across the country started receiving dozens of phone calls from clients who wanted to buy the featured wines, and soon all stores in the US ran out of Montelena and the other wines. The tasting was commented at large and reenacted by many wine lovers. In France, however, things were quite different. There were calls for Pierre Bréjoux to resign his position as Inspector General of the INAO, and Latour d'Argent director Claude Terrail scolded his sommelier Christian Vanneke for participating. "You don't understand, Christian. This is very bad for French wine business." Odette Kahn wrote a bitter article blaming Spurrier for nasty, slanted, and false conclusions, arguing it was a conspiracy to make Californian wines look better than they actually were. She went as far as to tell him in an event a month later that he had falsified the scores. The Englishman became persona non grata in Bordeaux and Burgundy for some time, and while on a trip to buy some wine a year later, he was kicked out of Domaine Ramonet. The verdict had turned out to be so shameful for French wine that 25 years later, judges still refused to talk to George Tabor about it when he wrote his book. In the French media, there were very few articles about it, and they were typically dismissive of the importance of the event. "Let's never talk about it again" seemed to be the consensus in France, but that was ignoring, deliberately, the resonance that the tasting had around the world. And the Judgment of Paris quickly became the most debated and analyzed wine ranking since the 1855 classification. In the aftermath of the event, four main complaints quickly emerged about the tasting. First, the 20-point scoring system and overall score calculation was too simplistic and didn't follow the rigorous methodology used in statistical analysis, such as the differing scoring style of each judge. So in the 1980s, two professors of economics at Princeton University analyzed the results of the red wine tasting again, and they obtained the same results with Stag's Leap number 1. Also, some argued that the French were not the best wines nor the best vintages, but Spurrier had already featured wines that were available for sale at the time, and the complaint on quality when all wines were either Premier or Grand Cru seemed unreasonable. Others pointed out that the French wines were too young and that the same tasting would give different results a few years down the road. These comments assumed that the French wines, especially the reds, would improve over time, while the Napa wines wouldn't. But nobody knew how Napa wines could age back then, and history has proven critics wrong. In 1986, the tasting was reenacted by Wine Spectator and also by Steven Spurrier himself, and every time, California won again. In 2006, a rematch was organized in London and another one simultaneously in New York. Both gave Ridge number 1 and Stag's Leap number 2. So it is now established that the Napa Cabernets featured in 1976 have aged beautifully and that this complaint wasn't relevant. Finally, some observers pointed out that blind tastings are inherently flawed and capricious. While blind tasting is a very difficult exercise and finding the origin is often really tricky, expert tasters should be able to assess quality. And since 1976, the judgment has been reenacted publicly multiple times with similar results. 3 years later, the Goemio magazine organized in France a tasting of over 300 wines from all over the world, called the Wine Olympics, in an attempt to re-establish France's superiority. The number one Chardonnay at the Wine Olympics was Trefethen 1976 from California. For me, the Judgment of Paris was first and foremost a useful wake-up call for the French wine industry that had been resting on its laurels for a while. In the 1970s, the quality of the plant material left to be desired in many vineyards, for the clones replanted after the war had often been selected for their productivity rather than their qualitative potential. The tasting didn't prove that Californian wines were better than Bordeaux or Burgundy. It only proved that France didn't have exclusive rights on high-quality terroirs capable of producing premium wines. The judges in 1976 were caught a little off guard, for very few of them had ever tasted Californian wines before. But there is a stylistic difference between Napa and Bordeaux or Burgundy, mainly due to the different soil and climate. Whether you prefer the character of Médoc or Napa is up to you. The tasting and its many reenactments ever since have only shown that both areas can produce fine wines. In fact, even French winemakers acknowledged it, and it is not a coincidence if Baron Philippe de Rothschild, the owner of Château Mouton Rothschild, launched the first vintage of his Napa Valley joint venture with Robert Mondavi Opus 1 in 1979, only 3 years after the Paris tasting. In his autobiography, Harvest of Joy, published in 1998, Robert Mondavi gave his opinion on the event. The Paris tasting was an enormous event in the history of Californian winemaking. Suddenly, people had a new respect for what we were doing. They saw we could make wines as good as the best in France. And in fact, after the tasting, Mike Gergich's phone started ringing non-stop with job offers. Eventually, he managed to open his own winery a few years later, Gergich Hills Wine Cellar. He passed away on December 13, 2023, at 100 years of age, leaving a remarkable legacy. Warren Winiarski remained at the helm of Stag's Leap Wine Cellars until 2007, when he sold it for $187 million. He still lives in the Napa Valley today. 20 years after the judgment of Paris, bottles of Chateau Montelena 1973 Chardonnay and Stag's Leap Wine Cellars 1973 Cabernet Sauvignon were placed in Washington DC's Smithsonian National Museum of American History. Stephen Spurrier passed away on March 9, 2021 in England. He was one of the most influential wine personalities of the late 20th century, and this podcast episode is a tribute to his legacy. If you wish to know more about the Paris tasting, I invite you to read the compelling book written by George Tabor, Judgment of Paris, published by Scribner in New York in 2005, on which today's episode is widely based. You can also watch the 2008 film Bottle Shock, directed by Randall Miller, that recounts the tasting, even if very loosely and with many inaccuracies. If you've enjoyed this episode, please give it a like on your favorite podcast app, and I'll be back next week with another wine story.